Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the unceded territory of the Mohawk and Algonquin peoples in Montreal. I'm your host, Gretchen King. In this episode...
And it breaks my heart that these deaths are going unjustified, not just to Kotambushi, but to our young men, our young women, our children. It's not fair, and it's not right, and it needs to change.
But first up, here are the headlines.
The Collective Opposed to Police Brutality, which is an autonomous group that is made up of victims, witnesses, and or those concerned by police brutality and all abuse perpetrated by the police. Since March 15, 1997, COBP has organized an annual demonstration in the streets of Montreal to highlight the International Day Against Police Brutality, which has already spread from Canada and Switzerland to Germany, England, France, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, through Nigeria, the US, and Mexico. Yesterday was the 22nd consecutive year that the protest was held in Montreal. For the first time since 2012, the protest organizers were not obligated to give the police a march itinerary, since the Quebec Court of Appeals recently struck down the requirement in Municipal Bylaw P6 to provide a route to the police before the march. Around 8:30 p.m., 40 minutes into the demonstration, the SPVM ambushed and charged the crowd at the intersection of St. Catherine Street and Amherst Street, causing multiple injuries. Three arrests were made, with three tickets and several counts of mischief laid. I am now joined by Arish Riha, member of Manifeste Sans Peur, a group that is calling for a ban on the use of plastic bullets and weapons in protests. So even for a demo against these atrocities happening by police, police were potentially using these weapons. So how do we, as a city, push the police to act without fearing? What are the actions that we can take to support change on these issues?
Well, collectively, what we can do is have those conversations. Collectively, what we can do is have media strategies. Collectively, what we can do is document and publish what goes on in demonstrations, and also stress the fact that this happens at every single demonstration. People don't feel safe in political demonstrations anymore. So collectively, we can ask that question, and we have many different tools. But I think individually, it's very important that people educate themselves on what are their rights and what are their obligations when they're dealing with the police in the context of a demonstration.
Thanks to Julie Bougil at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal for that headline. The following headline comes to Groundwire from Michael Welch of the University of Winnipeg's community radio station, CKUW 95.9 FM. It is a follow-up on last episode's story about the labor relations between Manitoba Safeway workers and the company Sobeys, which owns the chain.
What could have been a major strike action was successfully evaded on March 17th, when the bargaining team for Manitoba Safeway workers managed to secure a new collective agreement with supermarket chain store owner Sobeys West Inc. The new contract was just signed hours before the midnight bargaining deadline. The 12-person bargaining team reported bullying tactics used by Sobeys, such as the threat to close an undisclosed number of stores. Jeff Traeger, president of United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 832, sat on the bargaining team and credits the 98% strike mandate they were given the eve before this second round of negotiations as having been key to getting the company to back down.
We would not have been able to turn the company around and get them off of some of their significant concessions without that strike vote.
Acknowledging the new financial reality Sobeys is confronted with, Traeger explains the new contract protects existing benefits such as the no-cost dental plan and seniority rights, as well as building on those protections with wage gains in the third and fourth year of the contract. On Sunday, March 25th, workers got a look at the new contract and voted overwhelmingly to approve it. From Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
From Burnaby to Ottawa, protesters are demanding government action to stop Kinder Morgan's proposed Trans Mountain Pipeline and tanker project. On March 10th, over 10,000 people marched to Burnaby Mountain, where a Coast Salish watch house was built by Indigenous peoples, spiritual leaders, and youth. Since March 17th, more than 170 people have been arrested at the gates of Kinder Morgan, including several sitting MPs. Last Friday, 50 actions took place across Canada. In Ottawa, over 100 Ottawa Centre constituents marched to Environment and Climate Change Minister Catherine McKenna's office to ask that the minister meet with the Coast Salish Water Defenders at their watch house. Stand Earth provides groundwire, this audio recorded at the gates of Kinder Morgan.
For those of you who just joined us, we're here in Burnaby, British Columbia. It's a suburb of Vancouver. At Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline Terminal. Those people who have been arrested so far include, we've had an immigrant from Pakistan. We've had various retired people, including here today, there's a retired bus driver, some retired teachers. There's a retired former Air Force pilot in this group here. Yesterday, one of the women who were arrested used to work here. She used to work for the Trans Mountain Pipeline in the 1990s and decided to take bold action to oppose that pipeline's expansion. So she was arrested yesterday. The young people were arrested yesterday as well. And here you can see there's quite a few retired elderly people as well. If you want to take bold action, you can go to protecttheinlet.ca. That's protecttheinlet.ca.
That's it for headlines. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Groundwire, broadcasting community radio news from coast to coast to coast. Since 2008, Groundwire has been on air, produced and distributed by an experienced team of community radio news volunteers. The national coordination team is seeking new members of all experiences who would like to join in the collaborative production of Canada's only syndicated community radio news program. With this volunteer position, Groundwire offers an excellent opportunity to network at a national level with community media journalists and community radio stations across Canada. Join the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Visit www.groundwirenews.ca and click on Contribute for details. Now it's time for our feature stories. Walkouts for Indigenous justice took place on campuses across Canada. Initiated by law students at the University of Victoria, McGill and Concordia students joined the walkout to protest the ongoing killing of Indigenous youth and apathy for Indigenous lives in Canada's legal system. The Montreal walkout was hosted by the McGill Indigenous Student Alliance. CKUT's Julie Bougil brings Groundwire this report from the walkout for Indigenous justice.
This area, specifically this island, is called Jotjage. It was and still is a meeting place and a place of exchange. We have a responsibility to be knowledgeable, to care, and to use this privilege to enact change for the better. We're here to recognize that, and to recognize how unjust the system is, and how incredibly unjust what happened to these youth are and continue to be, and how incredibly unjust the things that happen to Indigenous people across Turtle Island are. So I'm happy you came today. Now go after being here, but remember that your action doesn't stop here. It doesn't stop today, and there are many ways you can reach out.
Our people keep dying and no one is held accountable. And this is today, so what is gonna happen tomorrow? And what are we going to do as a community to make sure that change happens? If you're studying to be in law, then get to know about these issues and know that Indigenous people are unbelievably resilient because after everything the government has done to us, we should all be dead. But we're still here and we're just trying to get a fighting chance. I have Jessica Cuyano. We have a project called the Ishkwe Project, and this is to help missing and murdered Indigenous women currently So when a woman goes missing who's indigenous, they can call her, and then she can navigate with the police. And she has prevention programs so that we can help future women to not go missing or to be accountable or to find out who they are and help them in Montreal, because nobody else is doing that. So when Carly had mentioned about looking into Native organizations, there are a lot of them. There is the First Peoples Justice Center that was just created a year ago, because our people are falling through the cracks. And unless we create organizations to fill those needs, it's going to continue. So like what Carly said, please look into the organizations that are doing the work, either join them, model them, and help us. Because when y'all came to this land, we helped you. So we would like it if you returned the favor. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Talia Belrose. I'd first like to start off with us just having a moment of silence for not only Tina, Colton, and Brady, but for every child that never came home from the residential school, and for every woman that has been lost. I hope they found their way home to the Creator.
I just introduced myself. My name is Yagodohne Gorale. It means she watches over them. And I'm here today. And I said I'm happy to be here, but I'm not. I'm not happy that we are here under these circumstances. I'm not happy that we are here, that we have to do this. This is ridiculous that these children, these youth are being murdered. They're being murdered, and it's unjust. Unjustly so. I'm a professor here at McGill. I teach Indigenous studies, teach contemporary resistance movements and food sovereignty, and we're looking at the systems of oppression that are happening to our people across the board. Systems that we talked about in education, in healthcare, in law, in food. It's ridiculous. But I want to give my thanks and appreciation. The young people here, I want to give my love, appreciation, and thanks to these young people that have made this possible today, that are standing up for their peers and for the future generations. I was heartbroken when I heard the outcomes of the trials. I'm a mother. I'm a mother to four young boys, and it breaks my heart that these deaths are going unjustified. Not just to Colton Bushi, but to the youth. It's our young men, our young women, our children. It's not fair. And it's not right, and it needs to change. But right now, I'd just like to give my appreciation to the young people here today.
Thanks to Julie Bougil at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal for that report. Crystal methamphetamine use in the city of Winnipeg is on the rise and is becoming particularly noticeable in the downtown area. Community members are becoming affected, and workers on the front lines are struggling with the challenges of addressing the needs of a vulnerable population in a social climate geared towards emergency responses over holistic and community-oriented approaches. Michael Welch of Winnipeg-based community radio station CKUW brings us these details.
So we have local kids working for us over the summer, and as a green team or as gardens workers, they were finding needles in our green spaces, and that was unusual. So every summer we'd find some. That summer we found many, many more, and so there was a sense of, oh, this is different.
That was Greg McPherson, the executive director of the West Broadway Organization, a neighborhood renewal corporation operating within Winnipeg's downtown, noting the dramatic increase in syringes littering his neighborhood. These disposed items are a sure sign that an epidemic of crystal methamphetamine has broken out in Winnipeg over the last 2 years. James Favel is the executive director of the Second Coming of Bear Clan Patrol, a community-led initiative sparked by the discovery of Tina Fontaine's body in 2014, and dedicated to nonviolent, non-threatening, and supportive strategies for providing security for Aboriginal and other community members.
We removed 18 needles from the city streets the first season. Second season, 300. Last year, 4,000. This year, we've already removed more than 2,500 needles from our community. And like what we've been seeing is a tenfold increase year on year. If we see that again this year, we're looking at 40,000 needles we'll find.
Bear Clan Patrol has come across more than needles.
Our first year, I think we found 19 bags of meth in 2016. Last year we found about, I think it was 7 or 8 bags of meth last year. So far this year we've taken about 2 or 3 bags off the street, but one of them was huge.
My name is Shelley Marshall and I work in the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority within the public health system. And specifically I support programs, that harm reduction programs. And those are programs that recognize that people are going to use drugs and out there in the community. And they may not be seeking treatment. Most drug use is not harmful, but when it is harmful, it's usually the social conditions that surround that. So what can the health system do to put out there for people who currently use drugs to make drugs less harmful?
The media often depict the crystal meth situation in Winnipeg in ways that present users as dangerous, while the hazards the users themselves confront can be understated.
The conflation of psychosis with violence, it's really not true. Most psychosis is not violent. And then those cases where you maybe somebody experiences a psychosis as a result of taking a lot of meth and not sleeping for many days, if they do become violent, that's what the media is going to pick up on. We don't talk about the quiet person who's just terrified to access any services and might freeze to death or hide and not get any care and have a terrible experience there. So I think that conflation of violence and meth and psychosis makes people afraid of people who use meth, who are, you know, regular everyday people.
In the middle of winter when it was minus like 30 outside, we had a woman walking around the community with no jacket on, bare sleeves. She didn't recognize in her mind that she was in danger, but of course we did. So we had to follow her around until she went into a place and then get the police to come and do a wellness check on her, because that's the kind of thing that scares us. We don't want to see another one of our community members frozen.
Frontline personnel are bracing for an increase in crystal meth-related incidents with the arrival of summer. Shelley Marshall argues that clues to finding solutions will depend on how we as a community relate and engage those users.
Nobody has asked people who use meth what they want and what they need. And so, like any other drug trend that we've seen, we tend to see a paternalistic response. And this idea that people who use drugs are not capable of making good, healthy decisions or knowing what they want or consenting to things. So it's not unusual to see a paternalistic and punitive response to people who use drugs.
You know, obviously there's poverty in general, and there's mental health issues that are unaddressed and a lack of resources. There's, you know, obviously in our communities we're dealing with the 150 plus years of colonization and inequality and racism. The officers I've spoken to on this particular issue have said themselves, this isn't a policing issue, it's a health issue, it's a social issue. But as a municipality, most of our resources are going into response. And it doesn't make sense to me.
From Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiyawak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
In Montreal, Doctors for Public Healthcare, or MQRP, organized a demonstration to unite against growing inequalities in the Quebec healthcare system. Groundwire was there and files this report.
We want to remind the government that caregivers provide essential services to Canadian families, some of whom receive professional care by foreign-trained nurses and other healthcare workers. While fulfilling our obligations as workers in Canada, we deserve at the very least access to quality healthcare and the ability to do away with the precarious conditions of our work and immigration status. It is time for positive and inclusive change to our healthcare system, not just for those at the top, but for all. Caregivers deserve better. Good enough to work, good enough to stay.
Rêvons ensemble, osons ensemble, avançons ensemble, luttons ensemble. Unis pour la santé. What do we want? When do we want it? What do we want? When do we want it? Privatization.
So tell me a little bit about your organization and how you've been involved with it.
So we're a group of medical students, residents, and physicians that are fighting to keep our public healthcare system public and well-funded and working well. And we were quite appalled, like many other doctors, I think, by hearing the working conditions of nurses, PABs, and other healthcare workers that were coming out and explaining how difficult their conditions were a few weeks ago, and then at the same time hearing that physicians were going to get increased, like tremendous increases in their pay. And we wanted to show our solidarity to those workers and to ask for the money to actually be used to increase patient services and to improve working conditions of the workers.
So Isabel, you spoke at the beginning of today's demonstration up on the stage. I'm sure you had a good look at who's gathered here. Can you tell me a little bit about who's here and what issues you're trying to make most prominent in today's demonstration?
I mean, the call was for patients group, advocacy groups, healthcare workers and unions to come together, and I see people from all these fields now in the demo. A lot of patients, a lot of nurses, a lot of people involved in advocacy for people that have poor access to healthcare, and that's really what we wanted to talk about. We had four demands, if you want. The first one was to cancel the pay raises for the physicians. The second was to use the money to provide better working conditions for healthcare workers. The third was to improve access to necessary services for patients, things like physiotherapy, speech language pathology, dental care, eye care, all the things that are not covered right now by Medicare. And the fourth demand was to ask that patients that right now have difficulty accessing the system because of, you know, structural issues, like they're from their immigration status, their ethnic background, or their monetary status, have better access, so that we work on improving access for all people living in Quebec.
So it's not been just recently that the Quebec health system has not been doing well. It's been going on for quite a while under different elected governments in Quebec as well. So why is it important today to be in the street?
I mean, the first thing is the system works pretty well. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be improved, but we actually have a system that works pretty well. Right now, I think, is the moment where voices need to be heard. People have been criticizing, including MQRP, have been criticizing what's going on for quite a while. But right now, we see that the government has really succeeded in making each worker or each patient fighting for their own thing and not having a general view of what's going on. And we felt as physicians that maybe we were the ones that could call for everybody to unite, because we're not member of a union. We haven't been involved in all the different changes of unions that the system has seen recently, and that we could maybe help advocate for patients or find patients to advocate for themselves to gather here today. So yes, we didn't plan on the weather being so cold, but we felt something had to be done right now.
And I guess the last question would be, what do you hope comes out of today?
Well, we hope that the government will listen, which is, we know, is kind of a false hope, but we still hope. And really, we hope that everybody who's gathered here today will start talking to one another, and that maybe there'll be plans to have discussions on how we can unite our strengths and go to try to change the system.
Thank you so much for your time today, Isabel. Good luck.
My pleasure.
That's it for our feature stories. We'll be right back.
Tu n'es pas maître de notre système, tant que nous y sommes. Tu n'es pas maître de notre système, t'as tout dit somme. Bonne embarrette à vous couper.
Now it's time for our community radio report. For this edition, we turn to the experience of community radio in Swaziland. Sibeli addressed the Community Radio in Africa workshop held during the recent World Social Forum in Salvador, Brazil.
Thank you so much, comrade, for this time, just to share with you about the role and the situation of community radios in Swaziland. I'm from a country of 1.2 million people, but it's a shock that in my presentation I'll be very brief because community radios are not allowed in Swaziland. The government does not give permits for the community radios because it would make it impossible for them to control that station. We have got one FM radio that is state-owned, and it is controlled every time. You cannot go there and just say whatever you want to say. They will just want to know what you want to say. Is it relevant to the government? If it's not, then they will stop you. They can't give you the access to that radio. I am working with rural women, and in Swaziland, the issue of education, especially in rural women, we were denied that access to go to school. So the issue of radio communities were going to be effective because each and every homestead will have access to listen to that if the government was going to allow that. But looking at the population that I'm working with, the rural women, they cannot even know what is happening. They are lacking information on what is happening in the country. The comrade who first spoke about, who made the first presentation here, who spoke about harassment of journalists and maybe detention sometimes, is what we see in Swaziland happening. Currently we have a journalist who has escaped from Swaziland to South Africa because of fear of his life. That is what is happening in Swaziland because the government is controlling everything. I am very happy to be in this session because there is a lot that I'm learning on the effect of the community radios, which I'll be taking back home to fight for, because we need this community radio for our populace to know what is exactly happening. This space has opened a lot to me to say we must advocate for these things even at home. I think I will end by saying there is one form of media, which is the newspaper in Swaziland. As I say that, it is controlled every time. Even if you want to write your story, maybe criticizing the government whatsoever, that story will go to the editor, and the editor will be victimized to say, you mustn't produce this in the newspaper. So that's how the media on Swaziland is very controlled by the state. So for me, I'm very happy to be in this session. Maybe that is what I can share now for Swaziland. Thank you very much for this session.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on traditional Mohawk and Algonquin territory in Montreal. We thank all of our contributors this week. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.